This Remembrance Day, we're taking a look at locations in the Sydney area that represent and honor Cape Breton's military past. I joined Coast 89.7 News Director Bobby Nock on a tour of downtown Sydney to discuss the monuments to those who have served. Okay, I'm joined today by Coast 89.7 News Director Bobby Nock, and we're here taking a look at some of Sydney's military memorial sites. So tell us where we're at today, Bobby.
Well, we're starting our tour here, Jacob, at the Cape Breton Highlanders Memorial, just right off King's Road here in Sydney. And I'm sure people drive by this every day or many times. I mean, I know I have. I think this is the first time I've actually been here. And we see here there are crosses someone has put in here, I'm assuming for little white crosses along both sides of the walkway to the memorial here. And I'm assuming someone has put those in with Remembrance Day coming up. So this memorial here has the 219 names engraved on it. And these are the Cape Breton Highlanders who died during the Second World War. And I think these crosses here, I haven't counted them, but it looks like there are 219 crosses here, one for every name on this memorial. And we're going to talk a bit more about the Cape Breton Highlanders at other points in our tour, but I wanted to take this opportunity to talk about some of the other units that fought in the Second World War and talk about the Canadian Army's performance and record in general, because I don't know if much is known about the contributions that Canada made and what an important role Canada did play. I think we tend to be quite modest, and I think a lot of times when we're learning about the Second World War in particular, we learn about the contributions Americans made, and you know, it's through things like their popular culture, of course. You know, they're able to make these big blockbuster movies that we can't afford to make in Canada. So when we learn about the Second World War through things like popular culture, we're learning about it usually from the American perspective. But I wanted to start off by mentioning another unit that a lot of Cape Bretoners were members of during the Second World War. And of course, it's called the Cape Breton Highlanders, but it didn't only have Cape Bretoners in it. There were men from across the country in the Cape Breton Highlanders, and mostly Cape Bretoners, but a lot from other parts of the country and the mainland as well. And this is true of other military units. And of course, Cape Bretoners served in other military units as well. And I want to talk about the North Nova Scotia Highlanders. They took part in D-Day. They were one of the units that landed on June 6, 1944, on the beach codenamed Juno. The Canadians distinguished themselves on that day. They were the Allied unit that advanced the furthest on D-Day, a fact that I don't think many people know. The other thing that happened on D-Day that, again, that overshadowing of U.S. Military history. A lot of people have seen Saving Private Ryan. Now, that focuses on the landing in Saving Private Ryan focuses on Omaha Beach. That's the beach where there are heavy U.S. casualties on that day. But it's not the beach that had the heaviest casualties per capita. In fact, Canada's beach, Juno Beach, had the heaviest casualties per capita on D-Day. The other thing I wanted to mention about the landing on D-Day, the Canadians had a tough nut to crack, because the part of the beach that the Canadians landed on was a built-up urban area. If you see pictures of Juno Beach from D-Day, you see houses right on the beach. That meant that the Canadians had to clear any German soldiers from those houses. It was house-to-house fighting, very tough fighting, whereas the other beaches were more rural areas. And not that the jobs at any of the units that landed on that day was easy, but certainly the Canadians landing in an urban, more built-up area, it was a tougher slog for them. And these are just a few little tidbits and facts to remember about how important a role the Canadians played. I wanted to also talk about, speaking of the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, as I said, there were many Cape Bretoners in this unit as well. I just finished talking about them. But anyway, as I mentioned, many Cape Bretoners in this unit. They played a part in, again, another very significant battle that Canada took part in the Second World War. It was the Battle of the Scheldt Estuary. Basically, what had happened is, after D-Day, of course, you have these armies advancing across, Allied armies advancing across Europe. The only port where they were able to land supplies, all, you know, you can imagine the massive amount of supplies that it would take to keep those armies going. The only port was the port that was taken on D-Day. That's the only place they could land supplies. That was 300 miles away, getting into September of 1944, because the Allies had advanced that far. It was crucial that they get a port closer to where the armies were. The British captured the port of Rotterdam and captured it intact. The other ports along the coast, the Germans had sabotaged them before they either retreated or surrendered, which meant they couldn't be used. But luckily, by stroke of luck, the port of Rotterdam was not sabotaged before it was taken. But the approaches to the port along the Scheldt River were occupied on both banks by German troops. Before that port could be used, the Germans had to be cleared out of there. The Canadian First Army was given that job, and the North Nova Scotia Highlanders took part in one of the battles to clear Germans from those approaches to the port of Rotterdam, the Battle of Breskin's Pocket in 1944. And anyway, the taking of that port by Canadians was a very crucial, pivotal part in the war. And again, these are things we should know about.
Absolutely. And like you say, you know, it might not be memorialized in the same way as the United States does for their military heroes, but here we are in Sydney, and we do our best here. And I think it just shows that those contributions by the Canadians were just as important as the Americans.
Very much so. And if you consider, you know, the size of the Canadian Army compared to the U.S. forces, I'd say we really did punch above our weight big time.
Excellent. Is there anything else that people should know about this memorial, Bobby?
No, just that it does have, I do believe, I haven't looked at it. Of course, yes, it's got the motto of the Highlanders. It's in Gaelic. The translation is "Breed of Manly Men."
Well, they've certainly lived up to that name, I'm sure.
Indeed. And we'll find out a bit more about the Highlanders on another one of our stops here.
Absolutely. Stay tuned.
Yes.
So we're continuing our tour of military memorials here in the Sydney area, joined by Coast 89.7 News Director Bobby Nock. Bobby, tell us where we are now.
Well, we're down here on the Sydney waterfront, Jacob, and we're at the memorial to the Merchant Navy. During the Second World War, Sydney and Halifax were the places where supplies got shipped to Britain. They were crucial for the war effort. In the early part of the war, Britain stood alone in Europe against Germany. France had fallen, and Britain stood alone. The U.S. didn't enter the war until 1941. So in September of 1939, Britain faced Germany alone in Europe, and it needed supplies from Canada in order to continue with its war effort. So convoys of ships left here, Sydney. They were called slow convoys out of Sydney. They were either older or slower ships that left, ships carrying heavier supplies, things like iron ore, oil tankers, left from here. And as I say, Sydney was a very crucial port during the Second World War. And the men on those ships, we see at the monument here, we see a sculpture here of four merchant mariners, and they're in what looks like a wooden raft or some part of the debris from a ship. You see them, two of the figures, calling out to sea, facing Sydney Harbor. We see another figure reaching for the fourth figure that's in the water. And this represents the sacrifice of merchant mariners during the Second World War. 1,600 merchant navy personnel from Canada and Newfoundland, that wasn't part of Canada yet in the Second World War, were killed. They actually had a casualty rate that was higher than the other military services. 1 in 7 merchant navy sailors were either wounded or killed. And the merchant navy veterans did not get veteran status in Canada until 1992, which means they didn't get the other benefits that other military veterans got. It took until 1992 for them to get that status and get the benefits that came to other veterans. A couple of other interesting things to note, if we're talking about areas around Sydney that we see remnants of today, from that time, from the Second World War, the Atlantic Memorial Park Project in Sydney Mines has the restored Chapel Point Battery, and of course Fort Petrie in New Victoria has a battery observation post from the Second World War there. So those are lasting reminders of the Second World War and the role that Sydney Harbour played. And people might not know this, but the Battle of the Atlantic brought the war literally to our doorstep. German U-boats were just outside the harbour here. There were, and that's a U-boat, a submarine. It's German, in German they call them undersea boats. So that, and they became U-boats for short. But those U-boats are outside the harbour here. There were, as I mentioned, submarine nets to keep those U-boats out of the harbour. But something also happened during the Second World War that was a reminder of how close the enemy was. The sinking of the ferry Caribou. That was a ferry from North Sydney to Port of Basque. It was sunk in October of 1942. 136 people, including civilians, died, and there were 237 people on board in total. So there's a legacy. As I say, we see here with the Merchant Navy Memorial, Fort Petrie, the Atlantic Memorial Park, reminders of a dark time in our history.
For sure, and this memorial is excellent at, you know, about showing that history of the Merchant Navy, which might not be as known to people as we might like to hear.
Exactly, and very, very important to the war effort and the eventual victory.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that information, Bobby. Our tour will continue.
Indeed.
Continuing our tour of significant military locations here in the Sydney area with Coast 89.7 News Director Bobby Nock. Bobby, tell us a little bit about where we are now.
Well, Jacob, we're at the gates to Victoria Park Armouries, which, of course, is the home of the Cape Breton Highlanders here in Sydney. And we're standing outside the Coriano Building. Now, the Coriano Building is named after Coriano Ridge. And that was a battle that the Cape Breton Highlanders took part in Italy
in August of 1944, and the Canadians were able to break the Germans' Gothic line in that battle. The Highlanders, as I say, were part of the battle. They lost 22 men killed in that battle, and 67 were wounded. The Highlanders fought in Italy and in Northwest Europe in the Second World War. Another battle of note in Italy for the Highlanders was the battle to take the Hitler line. And this was the leading to the approaches to Rome, south of Rome. And this was in May of 1944. The Canadians were the first of the Allied troops to break the Hitler line and open the approaches to Rome. The U.S. were also taking part in that offensive. And a very controversial thing happened in that offensive that angered the Canadian soldiers. And in these days when relations with the U.S. aren't the best, this is another example of where relations were soured. U.S. General Mark Clark, when he found out that the Canadians had broken the Hitler line and the approaches to Rome, he raced his Fifth Army to beat the Canadians to Rome and get the glory of being the first into Rome and have all the adoring crowds there. The Canadians did march through Rome themselves, but as one veteran said, it was at night when there was nobody there to cheer them on. So a controversial thing to the soldiers then. As I mentioned, the Highlanders fought in Northwest Europe, and they were part of the campaign to liberate the Netherlands. An important battle that the Highlanders took part in there was the Battle of Delfzijl, and that happened in late April and early May of 1945, so right at the end of the war. Delfzijl was heavily defended by concrete bunkers, and the Highlanders' losses in this battle were their greatest losses in the battle of the entire war. 62 men killed and 168 wounded, but they were successful in liberating the town of Delfzijl on May 1st, 1945, after a final assault the night before.
Thank you so much for sharing a little bit more about Coriano, Bobby.
You're welcome, Jacob, and we'll move on to our next military site.
And we're now at the next stop on our tour of historic military locations here in the Sydney area, and we're pretty close to our last one, the Coriano Building. Bobby, tell us where we are.
Yeah, we're just across the street here, actually, Jacob. We're overlooking Liberty Pier, and Liberty Pier is named in honor of the Cape Breton Highlanders. It's meant to recognize their role in the liberation of the Netherlands. And it was dedicated in 2020, opened in 2020. I mean, we call it today the second cruise ship berth. I think most people would know it as, but Liberty Pier is the official name of it. The name I find interesting, maybe I'll raise a contentious point here. To me, Liberty Pier sounds more American than Canadian. You think about the Statue of Liberty. The U.S. sold Liberty bonds during the Second World War. They actually had cargo ships that were called Liberty ships that took part in convoys going to Europe. And the other thing too, I mean, it is wonderful that the Canadians liberated the Netherlands. Of course, they liberated communities in Italy as well. The Germans had taken over in Italy. When Italy surrendered, they were allies with Germany, but German troops took over there. And I think the other point, these guys, the Cape Breton Highlanders and other Canadians who signed up to fight, they didn't sign up to liberate people in European countries. I mean, that wasn't their primary goal. Their primary goal was to defeat Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. And it was a happy coincidence that they were able to liberate people in these countries at the same time. But the ultimate goal was to defeat the Nazis, and they were successful in doing that. And I wonder if we should not call this Victory Pier in honor of that. And it's interesting that Canadians in Canada, victory bonds were sold in the Second World War, and that was the ultimate goal, victory, defeating the Nazis, and victory. But anyway, it's known as Liberty Pier for now, and probably will be forever, but there's my 2 cents worth on that one.
I kind of agree with you there. You know, just the word victory, it sounds a little bit more Canadian, you know, Queen Victoria, you know, it kind of brings that up. So I think victory does sound like a kind of appropriate, more Canadian name for a military victory.
Well,
even there.
It does. I wonder again about, you know, our Canadian sense not to brag so much might be part of why we want to focus on liberating peoples in Europe rather than actually contributing quite a large part to what was a victory. But anyway, interesting debate, I guess.
For sure. And we'll keep this debate going when we get to the last location on our tour.
Indeed.
So we're continuing our tour of historic military locations here in the Sydney area, and we're down still at the Victoria Armouries, and we're at the Cape Breton Highlanders Museum. Bobby, tell us a little bit more about where we are.
Yeah, we're in the museum here now, and we've got Jason Doyle with the Cape Breton Highlanders here with us. He's going to give us a bit of a tour.
Absolutely. I'm glad you guys were able to come down and see our museum. The Cape Breton Highlanders Museum chronicles the history of the Cape Breton Highlanders, who have been around for about 155 years. We started in Bedeque, and we've been involved in every major operation that the Canadian Army has done since then. So this museum chronicles all those different things that we've done and our history, and it's captured some artifacts and things like that to tell that story and be able to make sure that story doesn't get forgotten in the future.
You had an interesting fact you were telling us on our way up here about this site here, Victoria Park.
Yeah, one of the things that I learned as being part of the museum and working with the museum is that Victoria Park is actually the longest and oldest continuously manned military establishment in North America, which is a pretty kind of interesting fact that a lot of people don't realize. So that goes right back to the founding of Sydney, Louisbourg, the sieges and everything else.
Okay, yeah, interesting fact. So I see all kinds of things here, uniforms, a picture here. That looks like it's from the First World War here.
That one is from the First World War. We have pictures from both wars of the whole unit and some personal artifacts. We have medals from people who served with the unit. We have some artifacts between everything from uniforms and accoutrements that went with that to some older weapon systems that we have that were used, say, in World War II and that type of thing. So we have a lot of different things. And the museum was started by Mr. John Clark, who was a regimental sergeant major and then retired, and then he started to gather some of these amazing artifacts that we have. We have the war diaries from World War II, so that tells what the unit did every day, and it's pretty amazing to kind of see the stuff you don't get to hear about in the history books, just those little things, how the unit worked. We have newspaper articles and clippings and everything else, so it's a pretty substantial collection that we have here.
And I know you were telling us that you don't have room for everything in here.
Yeah, we have a really nice establishment here and some great displays, but we still have more stuff that we could display if we had the room. So we have some really good dedicated volunteers that have come up with these displays and laid it out so that there's a story being told as you tour the museum itself. It starts right back at the initial founding in Bedeque, and it goes right through to modern times.
I see something over in the corner here that looks, I'm guessing, comes back, goes back to the Bedeque era, that red tunic there.
So we have some of the tunics from when we were first established, and we also we weren't called the Cape Breton Highlanders then; we're the 94th Highlanders, and we actually have a set of dishes here that was used in mess functions and stuff like that back over 100 years ago, which is kind of pretty cool in that sense. That the china, it's a whole china set that's still here, still in great condition.
So that tunic, that would date back to the late 1800s?
Yes.
Wow, so where did that come from? Like, it looks to be in very excellent shape.
We can move over to it here and just take a look at it. So this one here is from 1883. It was worn by Sergeant A.J. McNeil, and he was eventually a captain within the unit within the 94th and was on active service during the Great War, so World War One. So we have a few different things like this that have come out. And it's really amazing because some of these older tunics and older uniforms that we've received, we actually used when we changed our name back to the Cape Breton Highlanders, we used them to establish what our dress uniform would be to make sure we capture all those old traditions and everything else. So this would be more of the infantry, the Royal Infantry School uniform. That would have been worn, not necessarily a Highlander uniform because it has pants, but we have some of those older kilts and stuff like that here to showcase those.
Yeah, that's right. Highlander units wear kilts.
Absolutely.
And I understand during the First World War, they actually wore the kilts in the trenches.
Yes, which was always, I don't know how they would have done it myself, because the kilt is comfortable, but it would be something else to have to wear it in those conditions
those
and everything else.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But we have like a lot of photos from the First World War and from even some of the stuff where they were set up here at home defense and doing training and stuff like that. So we were the 185th Battalion at that point in time. And they were established, we have some photos here from Broughton where they established a camp there. It's no longer there anymore. The ruins are still there, but they were stationed there and did a lot of training there.
And they also trained at Aldershot on the mainland, did they not?
Yes. So they would have done their initial training here, and then they would have went to Aldershot, then would have moved over to England and that type of thing. So we even have some of the headdresses. And it's interesting that the hat badges are always a sought-after item. So we do have 185th and 85th hat badges, which are, you know, pretty distinct and different, and somewhat rare, some of them.
You know, I see pictures here of soldiers in kilts. This is, again, First World War.
Yep. So, and we, as we moved through, we didn't, when we went overseas as part of, in World War One, we didn't go over as the 185th. We actually moved into other units. That's how it worked at that point in time. We were still Highlanders. When we moved on to the Second World War, we went over as the Cape Breton Highlanders and kind of, we perpetuate all of those other units that came before us. So that's our lineage that kind of comes through that. And as we move to our next cabinet here, this is actually the uniforms that we wore in World War II. So again, the wool tunics, the kilts. We did wear pants at that point in time, but the kilts were still a big part of everything. So there's a lot of really cool history associated with the Cape Breton Highlanders and what we did in World War II, and some of the great stories that were captured and done. So these next cabinets all portray some of the stuff that was done there and some of the artifacts that were either captured by the Cape Breton Highlanders or have been donated to us to showcase what they went through and where they were at and everything else.
Yeah, I see a steel helmet, which also would have been worn in the First World War.
Yeah. So, and we have even things like the clackers, so that would be the alarm for if there was a gas attack, they would, you know, whip that around and it makes a loud noise and that type of thing. Some of the bugles and bags that were used,
a canteen,
and some of the really, like, some of the great pictures of some of the members as they're getting ready doing their training and everything else and the uniforms that we wore, including some of the mess dress. So this would be the formalized dress that an officer at that time would have worn if they had to go to a mess function as part of things. So they lived their whole thing when this was going on. This was their history and what they did.
Yeah, that the dressed uniform, they literally a black tie,
yep,
with the white shirt and a red
tunic. And the red
tunic
goes back to the British history and everything else. They got rid of wearing the red tunic in the field, but they still wore it for mess functions and everything else. And we have some of the other uniforms that were worn, some of the battle dress where it was pants, and even some of the stuff, like, it's all wool. Wool's great, but wearing pants and tunic that's all made of wool, heavy wool, all the time is not necessarily the most comfortable thing that I can think of.
Yeah, I notice here there's a jacket that looks like it's made of cotton. Would that be from the Italian campaign?
That would be either the Italian campaign there, just a little bit lighter, some more of the arid stuff that would have been worn. But the basic tunic and everything else was the wool that they wore. And, you know, they just it worked well because wool, even when it was wet, would be warm and, you know, it dries well and everything else. And we do have some of the German uniforms and flags and stuff that were part of the things that were captured.
See a couple of German helmets here.
Yep, there's some helmets, a uniform, a flag. And there's actually, we have one of the things over here that is actually quite sought after by historians, especially from the War Museum, is our eagle. The eagle was captured in one of the last battles of the war. It was at an SS headquarters, and it hung above the stage. And I'm not aware of any other artifact that still exists. It's made out of oak, and it's a carving of a large eagle, about 6 feet across, and it's perched on top of a swastika. So it was captured and brought back. Interesting story. I was doing an interview with one of our veterans that we just lost this past summer at 101. Joe Burke. I asked Joe, I said, how did they get it back? Like, you know, it's so big, how did it come back overseas? And he goes, I don't know. I'm like, oh, come on, Joe, you can tell me now. He goes, no, they're all sworn to secrecy and no one would tell how they got it back. But we have it here and it's always been here. So it's a pretty prized possession in the sense of what it is. And it's a war trophy that we brought back to show that we don't want to go back to something like that in the future.
So was that a Del Seal?
That was a Del Seal. That's where that was captured. So we also have photos from the location where it was. So you can see it in the photo above the stage where it hung, and it was captured then. It's striking when you first see it, simply because what it is and what it has on it, because it's, you know, it signifies so much. But it is a piece of history that's important to have, to show that we don't want to go back to something like that.
Right, yeah, you know, it is impressive when you see it, and I guess we'll, as you say, we'll never know how they got it here.
Exactly. And it's something that we keep. We want to make sure that the story of how it came to be here, in the sense that it was captured from the war and stuff like that, and that we don't want to go back to what that represented for the Germans at that point in time. So it's definitely something that's really cool.
Okay, and we have some more uniforms in the display cases over here.
We have some of the more of the modern ones as we're moving along. We have one picture here also I just want to draw your attention to. This was the last photo that was taken before they went overseas in World War II. So this was taken in Ottawa area and at the Connaught Ranges in Ottawa. What was really cool about this, we have this photo scanned and we have it high resolution so you can actually see the faces in it. I showed Joe this picture, said, hey, Joe, do you remember this? He goes, yeah, I'm right over here. And he showed me exactly where he was. And when you look at it, you can actually like, yeah, okay, that's Joe. That's exactly where he was. And so it was really kind of neat to capture that and to show this is the full battalion before it went overseas.
Big panoramic picture.
Those old-time panoramic photos.
You probably couldn't do that today with the cameras we have.
Probably be a little bit more difficult to do it. Again, we have some more of the older, you know, post-war uniforms, and as we're moving through, and some of our pipes and drums uniforms, what our pipers and drummers would wear, and how they would perform. And we have some amazing pipers still, and some amazing people that have come through. Our pipe major, as an example, his family goes all the way back to Vimy Ridge. His great-grandfather performed, and when I say performed, he played the pipes at the battle. His father played at Vimy during World War II. He played at Vimy at one of the anniversaries. So three generations have played, you know, at the battle site sort of thing. His grandfather signed up again for World War II, and they found out he was 65 when they were about to go into Sicily, and they sent him home. They said, what are you doing here? Like, you've already done your part. So, like, so we have some pretty amazing stories around some of that stuff around, you know, the Pipers and what they do. And they would be our stretcher bearers during battles and stuff. But they also played a really key, important role being morale and kind of striking some fear when they heard the pipes coming and everything else.
We have more uniforms here.
We have some more uniforms. These, again, will be more afterwards. We have a really cool display here of the McNeils from Iona. It's three generations, and actually the fourth generation was here and gave us this display. The great-grandfather, the grandfather, and his father, they all have won the DSM, the Distinguished Service Medal, and starting at World War I and going down through to World War II. He's not familiar with any other family that has that lineage of that many people winning that award or being given that award. So it's pretty cool stuff when it comes to that. He himself served in the military, served in the airborne. He was actually at the FLQ crisis and served then. So he's, you know, really kind of connected to the history of it and brought us that. So these are some more of the uniforms as we're kind of moving away from World War II, kind of in the more of the modern style. These would be the dress uniforms that we would have worn back in the 50s, 60s as we're kind of moving through there.
I noticed the uniforms, even at that point, are kind of modeled on a British-type uniform.
They absolutely are, and which actually is really interesting is our dress uniform now is actually moving back to this style of uniform. They're actually in the process right now of changing from what we wear now to this style that's here in this case. So that same olive drab, the Sam Brown belt, very similar style in that sense, which is kind of cool. As we move along here, we were into more of the modern era of our dress. These would be the 80s, 90s, 2000s, some of the CF dress, some of the things that have gone away. The tan dress jacket, that's gone now. It's just the green one that we have. And again, like I said, we're changing it again. The modern mess uniform and everything else. And even we have a copy, or it's not a copy, it's the uniform of a padre who served two tours in Afghanistan with us. So Father Don McGilvery, local priest, he lives in Antigonish now. He did serve in Afghanistan as a padre. So we have his uniform that he wore when he went to Afghanistan.
Okay, the tan with the camouflage.
Digital camo, yeah. So we have a lot of really interesting things. Some of the more modern stuff is the difference between the Nova Scotia Highlanders and the Cape Breton Highlanders. For a long time in the 50s, when they changed their name from the Cape Breton Highlanders to the Nova Scotia Highlanders 2nd Battalion, we had different hat badges, just a little differences. Interesting story is that we were always the 2nd Battalion Nova Scotia Highlanders CB, or Cape Breton. You were never allowed to forget that Cape Breton part. I remember as a young officer, I forgot to put that in on a memo and got told very sternly not to do that, which eventually led us to becoming back to the Cape Breton Highlanders. So some really interesting kind of differences and seeing the differences compared so that people know that we always were the Cape Breton part of the Highlander group and everything else.
Well, that's great, Jason. I think we're running out of time here a little bit, but just, there's one more thing you want to point out, I think.
One thing I do want to point out is the story of Alphonse Hickey. Alphonse was killed during the Second World War. He actually, the action that he was involved with, he stayed behind as the members of the unit moved off a hill and was attacked by the Germans. He held the Germans off and eventually was killed from that action. They put him in for the Victoria Cross, and he wasn't awarded it. And it was one of those kind of political things that it didn't get awarded because they were moving off the hill rather than going forward. And it's a pretty amazing story about Alphonse and what he did, and just showed the grit and the determination and everything else that the Cape Breton Highlanders and the guys from Cape Breton looked after each other and kind of came through and what they did in the war.
They're very stingy with the Victoria Crosses, aren't they?
Absolutely, and he was awarded what's called a mention in dispatches, But for what he did and the actions that he took, it was pretty amazing. So, you know, he's a hero in our books when you look at it. You don't need the medal to be recognized as a hero, because he definitely was one.
Okay, and he's got his own plaque here, Pride in Place here, so we don't forget him.
Absolutely. And everyone else.
Exactly. Well, thank you for your time, Jason. It's great. And, I mean, there's more. We could spend more time here. Anyway, we got a good look at what you had here, and a good overview of the history of the Cape Breton Highlanders. So it's
great. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you coming down and shining the light on this here. It's really great to be able to showcase our history and those of us, those that have come before us. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our tour of military locations in downtown Sydney. I want to thank Coast 89.7 News Director Bobby Nock for sharing his insight on Cape Breton military history, and to Jason Doyle with the Cape Breton Highlanders. For Coast 89.7 News and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Jacob Postlewaite.